Whenever feasible, one should always try to eat the root. Would you join me at the table?
Welcome to Eat the Rootcast, a podcast about NBC's Hannibal and the works of Thomas Harris. I'm Cooper, and I have with me...
Hi, it's Miko.
And this is Ophelia.
And tonight is Thanksgiving.
Yes.
And we thought, what more appropriate television series for Thanksgiving than one that revolves so thoroughly around food?
Yes, exactly.
We are talking about episode 206 tonight.
Futamono.
See, I always pronounce it the American way, which is futamono.
Yeah, very
which is
typical.
Sort of. Well, it's a lidded dish, a soup, often. Don't really know what that means or that it has any connection to tonight's episode.
Yeah, that is interesting. I don't know. Do they give any more explicit description of what the lidded dish is? Just that it is a lidded dish?
Just that it's a lidded dish.
Yeah.
Directed by Tim Hunter, written by four people, Andy Black, Brian Fuller, Scott Nimerfro, and Steve Lightfoot. So there's a whole bunch of people that we are very familiar with,
yeah.
And then one newbie who also gets a story credit.
Oh, that's interesting.
Which I thought was interesting.
So maybe there was a concept that they brought
like
to the table.
Like he pitched it. Well, you know, some TV series are required to have a certain number of non-staff written scripts.
Ah.
A certain number of... freelance.
Mm-hmm.
And so it may be something like that.
Mm-hmm.
We are drinking Vina Fuerte Tempranillo.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Which is from Aldi.
Yes. Aldi is
and Aldi has
amazing wine.
A really surprising good selection of wine.
Yeah. And this is strong wine.
It is.
Vina Fuerte.
Vina Fuerte.
Yeah.
So we got to dig right in because this was, I don't know that we've ever taken more notes than this episode.
Yeah.
Every sequence was so dense with amazing dialogue, big turning points. I mean, this was a game changer of an episode across the board. And let's start with Hannibal composing on the harpsichord.
On the harpsichord.
Because that's where the episode starts. So I think we'll start with that.
Okay.
So, we knew Hannibal played the harpsichord.
Yes.
And this is something directly from the books. Hannibal plays the harpsichord and the theremin. Mm-hmm. And we knew Hannibal's a composer. But this is really cool because we have an actual composition that's attributed to Hannibal, that's a believable composition for Hannibal,
right.
And that takes us through the entire episode as we go, this composition. And we all, of course, have to give credit to Brian Reitzel, our composer, who usually doesn't compose as much music for the show as sound effects and discordant things. So it was a lovely thing.
It did follow a wonderful through line for the whole episode,
yeah.
though, because we do keep revisiting it and certain chords, and it orchestrates the dinner party and everything. It was a nice through line.
And I really liked seeing how a harpsichord is played.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're all very familiar with how it looks when a piano is played. You know, the striking of the strings.
Strings, yeah.
But then a harpsichord, it's plucked strings.
Mm-hmm.
So all those little
fingers,
the mechanation inside the harpsichord, and it was done in slow motion, mm-hmm. and it was that beautiful red and black out there. And then you see the for a person who plays the piano, it's always unique to see the flipped keys of the harpsichord, where it's the black
keys. Yeah, it's black keys
with
the
white accent. So I really enjoyed that.
Mm-hmm. And I also kind of like that they bring back the harpsichord, because I do believe, if memory serves, that it's similar to the violin, where the catguts are the perfect strings for it. I was going to look this up, but I completely forgot.
Yes, yes.
I always thought that was very sort of interesting.
Yeah, absolutely.
For Hannibal.
Well, and when Hannibal encountered Tobias, he was specifically talking about playing stringed instruments and the value of them. So it's nice, these little callbacks. It's nice, these little book references. This episode really weaves the books in so well, just all over the map, with Silence, with Hannibal, with Red Dragon. Just we get little
we're getting a little taste bit of everything in this, almost definitely.
And again, this is an episode where I feel like the show is firing on all cylinders. I mean, everything here is just tight.
Yeah, and then since we you know, we're now focusing on just the Ripper being our killer of the week, we're able to focus more because
we're not dealing with other killers.
There's no, like, we're into a different type of investigation. It's not now trying to find some random dude and then having to deal with their backstory and who they are and how they are found. We're not going to get the answer to this for quite some time. So it enables them to take that screen time and focus it on a lot of other really fascinating things in this sort of game-changing episode.
And this is an episode where the show sort of takes this curve where we leave reality more so. You know, we talked about, I talked about the unreality of the tableau in the last episode.
Mm-hmm.
This tableau is far more unrealistic, especially to consider that a parking lot was ripped up overnight.
Yeah. Mm.
This tree was somehow transported there, buried there.
Yes.
Looked as though the tree had been growing out of it. Like, that staging takes time.
So we again have, we're being asked by the show to agree that that doesn't matter.
Right.
Yeah.
Imagine. And
Hannibal
they get us
is
to
magic.
Agree. By producing this beautiful piece of art.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
And then the flowers.
Oh, yes.
Oh, my God.
All across this episode. You know, speaking of that, the composing, how about when we see the notes on Hannibal's page?
And they become the flowers.
With that intense music from from Brian Reitzel as we're transitioning.
That was fascinating.
We're going into this very surreal place with the show where it's not afraid to take extremely non-traditional risks.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as artsy as the show has gotten, it's still artsy in a sort of traditional for television way, not a traditional for network television. It's never been traditional for network television.
No.
But
right.
We're taking sort of this segue into the kind of thing. Actually, you remember the movie The Cell?
Yes, I remember The Cell.
Yeah,
I'm seeing a lot of that.
And, yeah. Almost performance art.
Yes.
Because
it was in a dream world.
Yeah.
So you are in the mind of the person.
And the tableaus on this show are starting to resemble that type of artistry more and more. And I love it. I think it's beautiful. And The Cell was also gorgeous.
Visually fascinating. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Really bad serial killer story crafted onto it, really gorgeous in general.
But so pretty.
We do revisit this because we're constantly seeing him putting the notes.
He's building his composition throughout the episode. And I like the little sequence where Alana's playing chopsticks.
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
And I don't know why Hannibal was playing chopsticks alongside her in a different chord, but it really sounded terrible.
It didn't sound good.
You know, chopsticks has another part, and it's not just chopsticks again. So I don't know why he would do that.
There's
I don't
a whole
understand.
Thing, yeah.
But if only every problem could be solved with a simple waltz. Yeah,
I thought that was kind of an interesting choice to say that, because chopsticks is a waltz, and he wasn't composing a waltz. And I wasn't like, okay, I'll buy it. But I thought that, unless it was a line from something specific.
I don't know.
She was quoting something.
Maybe.
Yeah. I just thought it was interesting to choose waltz.
And this is this sequence here, you know, we're getting a little ahead, but it's what turns the Alana and Hannibal relationship. I'm curious for your thoughts, Miko, about that. Because rewatching the series, it doesn't feel out of left field.
Mm-hmm.
When we were originally watching the series, it felt
like,
hell did that come from?
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we're not, I've heard this on other podcasts. The AV Club's reviews felt that way. Like, what the fuck? Alana and Hannibal?
I mean, I'd like to interject on the surprise factor.
Noted.
Notice.
When I was watching it initially, I knew that they had a history, but I didn't notice all the subtle hints, like the glances
They've
that she would give him.
Flirting since...
The flirty banter.
Yeah.
And what I thought to myself is, professionally, no, you do not get involved here because, well, you may not be his doctor and he may not be your doctor. You have a professional relationship. For you to turn that into a romantic one while Will, who is also somebody that you had a brief, you know, whatever encounter that was romantic, and you're both entangled with Will, that being your joining piece, your joining person, and it just the timing of everything, it just is so suspect. It's not the time for a romantic relationship to begin. And maybe it wasn't supposed to be romantic. Maybe it was
that's the thing is, I didn't get from it that it was supposed to be romantic.
A hookup. But
yeah.
At the same time, I was just, him? That's who you would pick? When all of this is going down and all of this, you know, accusations going out. I mean, it's almost like, what are you attracted to? The bad boy kind of. Insinuation that's going around Hannibal, like he may not be a bad boy, but he's got all these.
I think it's not that the bad boy thing. I think it's sort of the opposite because she's rather shocked that Will had him killed.
Tried.
Yeah.
To have him. And,
well, yeah. No, she's shocked.
Yeah, and I think perhaps it feels more of a betrayal. That she's been trying, basically, to think of Will not as a person who could have, you know, killed these people.
Oh, yeah.
And then here he goes after she's been, you know, ardently, defending him, going into court and trying to prove that this is someone who couldn't do something like this. And then out of left field, he does something very vicious. And she...
Lucidly, too.
And she even says he's not afraid anymore.
Right.
And he's doing things, where he's not afraid of the consequences, and that's what's making him dangerous.
Yes.
So I don't think she's thinking of Hannibal as sort of like going to the dark side. I still think she thinks of him as a colleague, and in this time where her sort of universe is really... been turned over and upside down. She really doesn't know who Will is now and is kind of, I think, might even be afraid of what he's become.
Yeah.
Because of these choices that he's making. When she's walking with the dog, I see the best of Will.
Yeah.
In the dogs, yes. In the absolutely. Dogs.
And she's trying to figure out.
And a Winston alert there.
Oh, yes.
Winston
actually turns and looks at the camera.
Looks at the camera. Exactly. I thought that was really cute. So I don't know I doubt it's calculated. I doubt they've been flirting. I think in other, podcasts I've mentioned that.
Oh yeah.
There was flirty banter.
Yeah. And they actually have nice chemistry going back and looking.
It seems so jovial and surface and I don't know. I guess it's the part that struck me and I've got it in my notes is that it seems to happen right after she tells Hannibal, I mean, it's the end of the party. Everyone's gone. She tells Hannibal, Jack is treating you like a suspect.
Yeah.
That would scream so many alarms and red flags, like, back off. Even if you were interested in going down that path with Hannibal after this dinner party. Jack, of all people,
is starting to treat you
like a suspect. And collecting your food to have it tested. She knew that was happening.
I don't particularly like it. I don't like that this is what they're doing with Alana Bloom, who is a very soulful and interesting character. Mm-hmm. It feels like last season, they sort of lost what to do with her, so they pushed her at Will.
Yeah.
This season, they lost what to do with her, so they're pushing her at Hannibal. Mm-hmm. And really, all that's doing is setting us up for the same reveal to her that we got for Will. You know, the last episode of the first season is... Oh, Will's a killer, and she has to deal with the fact that this man she sort of loved is a killer. And I feel like This is what I was talking about in the first season, where the show does not quite know what to do with its female characters.
No.
And now that we've killed Beverly...
Yeah, there's really not a whole lot left at this point.
I miss Beverly.
I know.
She was a great character.
I liked her so much.
And I think what they've been doing... I also think...
She can't come back.
Well, she could be in Will's memory bells.
I also think that this is a device. And mostly the device is that Hannibal needs leverage against Will.
Yeah.
And he's using Alana very strongly very early on.
Yep.
You know, there is a not so subtle hint.
Mm-hmm.
And we get it twice in this episode in one of those brilliant Hannibal cuts where at the beginning when Will says, "Who does he have to kill before you open your eyes?" And then we get that beautiful sort of slow-mo shot. Where she's laughing and smiling.
Yeah.
And it's wonderful the way they're shooting her. Mm-hmm. It's wonderful the way they're dressing her.
Mm-hmm.
It's wonderful the way her dialogue is. I mean, she's not written like an idiot. It's the writing about her. It's just plot contrivance.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't working for me. It makes more sense this time around. I still don't like it.
Yeah.
I think that's it for me. It kind of, I guess in a way I kind of feel like, aw, no, don't go in that room.
Yeah.
It's kind of like the girl running up the stairs instead of out of the house.
Mm.
I'm just like, don't, because I've got the foreshadowing, and I know where this is going to go, and you're just going to be heartbroken again, and question, doubt yourself, and all sorts of things like that. And I just don't want that for Alana as a character.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that part, when you talk about being a disappointment,
mm-hmm.
That I thoroughly agree with. That choice in that moment, I understand... with the words she's using, that this is a way of dealing with grief, and this is, I don't know, maybe it's a way of rebelling against a lot of the craziness she's being sort of batted back and forth between what is right and what is good, and
being treated like not an object, but being treated like pawn to be played by Jack Crawford.
Mm-hmm.
Against, you know, Will. Oh,
and so so now Will has demonstrated that he's beyond her mm-hmm. help.
Yes.
And Jack is joining Will's side and not listening to her advice.
Mm-hmm.
So actually, what, remember when in season one when Hannibal, when she says, "Why didn't we ever have an affair?" Hannibal?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And then there were reasons, and I think they were all related to business colleagues, you know. But I think this feels like Alana has decided she is done with the business.
Mm-hmm.
And if she's done with the business, and that was the only thing standing in her way,
right?
This is an erudite man who really gets along well with her, who knows what she likes, who takes care of her with what she likes, who cooks brilliantly. I mean, there is a lot. And
has been showing her a lot of very
beer
positive
in
attention.
His fridge.
Later, you know, when they're lying in bed, they have that great exchange about funeral sex, and that
reminds him of being alive.
It reminds him of being alive, and that Will, this is their funeral for Will. They have lost Will. Will is beyond them. But then they also confirmed this was more than funeral sex. There are a lot of other reasons
mm-hmm.
to do what we did.
It
wasn't just a hookup. It wasn't just a one night thing. So again, there's a lot of legitimacy
mm-hmm.
to the move.
They validated it.
It's just, again, couldn't the female be more interesting than just, it feels like she's a plot contrivance instead of a character.
Right. Or that this doesn't seem as organic as it should.
Right.
You
can see the setup. It comes at a convenient time for this to happen, because then it gives him the alibi. Mm-hmm.
Well, and that's the 100% convenient thing.
Well, I mean, they show you that. That's not even like you discover it an episode later.
No,
they show you it immediately. Immediately using her as an alibi. Mm-hmm. Immediate. Like, and I guess that's the other thing, too, because I feel especially betrayed by Hannibal in this, that he's doing this to her. And I'm immediately finding out about it. It's not like...
Right. It's not like later on, they're like, well, she was drugged.
Right. Yeah. Well, I just got my rocks off. Now I'm going to use you as an excuse to go do something naughty.
Yeah.
Wonderful. Thanks, Hannibal. Jerk. That's rude. That's rude. That is rude. If she woke up and noticed he was gone... She could totally call the rude card.
There is nothing You're more
being rude,
rude
Hannibal.
Than going off to kill Gideon.
Leaving after sex to go kill someone.
Yeah.
Or not kill, but kidnap. Yeah.
And this plot point also has the little throwaway of last time someone rang my doorbell this early, it was a census taker. And everyone in the audience was, I see what you did there.
Yeah.
Everything else in this episode is so well played. All the other references are so well played. This is fun.
But it's very obvious.
I feel the show is above this now. Yes. Yeah. It's like a dip down to, it's like Gotham.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like every character is like, oh, he's going to be the Penguin in a couple of years.
Right.
Can you believe it?
Yeah, you get it.
It's like, oh, look, he has an umbrella.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, okay, we understand.
We get it.
We understand.
Yeah. There is kind of a lot of that. A lot of tells, a lot of sort of melodramatic ways of revealing things. And it's not the style of this show.
No. But otherwise... It's played very well.
Oh, yeah.
Let's slide all the way back to the beginning.
Okay.
So Will is in his cage.
Yes.
Jack enters. Let's talk about the cage.
Because
I had forgotten to mention this last time, probably because we talked about the Hannibal locations in Toronto. So from the beginning of this season, these cages have been driving me crazy.
They're such a wonderful piece of set design.
It looks fascinating. Yeah. It's, you know, the way it's shot and the way they use it beautifully. Mm. In almost every episode, they frame somebody interesting in it, whether it's a silhouette or between the bars. They do a beautiful shot in this episode that puts like chills up my spine, using the top grid.
Oh, yeah.
And they line up Will's eyes, and it is...
When he looks up at
the end, who figures that out? Mm-hmm. Who realizes that perfectly lines up and does the creepiest shot ever? You know, so they use it brilliantly. But I kept going, well, what the hell is this thing? Because we were trying to figure out, why are there these solitary cages...
Yes, exactly.
...in a room? And they don't always use this. Sometimes they're in a room where they sit across a table. And then he has... So... Finally, I sat down and I think I did a search for, cages, in mental institution. And I come up with an article, I think it was from 2010, and that, where they talk about that they are group therapy cages. But what I find.
Which was our theory.
Yeah. And that's one of the things we had talked about. We were trying to figure out, like, what could this possibly be useful for? And that it seemed like, well, you could have many people in a room. And have group therapy, even though in the show, quite often people are alone. But we thought, well, maybe it's a way of doing therapy where you don't have to be in the room with the person. So technically, that is what it is. They are considered group therapy cages. But the reason why this article was interesting is that there was actually a group of people fighting against it, a group of psychiatrists, because they felt that it was sort of cruel and unusual.
Demeaning. Treating them like animals.
Like animals in a cage. Exactly. But the whole purpose was they were being criticized that the mentally ill were being incarcerated in these, hospitals for the criminally insane, which are basically prisons,
right?
Yeah,
but not actually dealing with their illness.
Okay, yeah, that's true. Yeah, but the most part, they just drug them up and leave them
exactly in their room. They were not providing them with any kind of help or any way of getting figuring out how to deal with their mental illness. They were just basically thrown into, you know, a prison. So they tried to bring in psychiatrists and bring in and do therapy, but you do have the criminally insane.
Yeah.
You do have people who are violent. They make the joke several times about, being out of peeing range.
Yeah. I'm a cutter, not a pisser.
I'm a cutter, not a pisser. And apparently that was one of the reasons why they had them, they had to have them so separate from the psychiatrist is they would do that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And separate from each other.
And separate from each other because they would do, and also,
bite or stab or whatever they could do. And honestly, we're talking about the criminally insane. Mm-hmm. They have done something that wasn't just, okay, bad, you killed. It was, oh my God, you did what to who with exactly. this? With, huh?
This is a special kind
of. We don't even understand you're kind of crazy.
Right.
Cage.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
In the cage.
In the cage.
I can't hear you unless you're in the cage.
In the cage. And then they would even have the psychiatrist that was helping them would also have a vest on so that if anybody managed to get to them, mm-hmm. there was no way that they could be stabbed. That was the description they have is of this, the guy who comes in to do therapy, you know, has his vest on and everything underneath his jacket, and he takes out a guitar and he starts singing, Sitting on the Dock of the Bay with a group of people.
But when you were reading me this article, it felt like somebody at Hannibal read this article.
I really felt that when I read
because
it.
Because so much of the stuff that had been referenced with the cage specifically were referenced in this article. So it was really a fascinating thing. And I'd like to put a link to that on the page.
But yeah, it was really fascinating to read. And then what they're saying is that by putting them in cages, it makes them feel like animals. But then there is, I don't know if they ever resolved it because I didn't do further research, but it's, we want to help them. We can't help them if they're not,
if we don't remove that ability.
The danger, exactly.
Well, because if they see the opportunity, they're going to take it.
Mm-hmm.
And with insane people, that barrier is sometimes missing. Mm-hmm. That, okay, this is wrong, don't do it. You get the compulsion to bite someone. You get the compulsion to hurt someone.
Mm-hmm.
Whacked on it. That's right. How what got you there in the first place. So with removing that opportunity, you're going to see a decrease in that particular violent behavior.
We keep having these really interesting moments of Will in the cage and being very introspective. But then I love when Jack enters and he says, you're moving smoothly.
Yes, yeah.
Smoothly and slowly, and slowly carrying slowly. Your concentration like a brimming cup.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Will is on top of his game now. I mean, and he's hiding nothing.
He has full capacity now. The, you know, encephalitis is gone.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. He has been treated.
Now he has contempt for those who put him in
here. Was the word for the happy anticipation of being able to feel contempt.
That is such a weird thing to talk about.
I couldn't wrap my brain around that.
No, it's the common, first of all, yet
common
as of yet not named emotion.
Of the happy
anticipation. What a strange thing.
Yeah, it was. You know,
but a bit lyrical at the same time.
Oh, yeah.
It sounds beautiful, but afterwards you're like, oh, wait.
Yeah, I've always just been with that line, like, I don't understand what you're trying to tell me.
I don't know if you really.
You may be batting at the next level.
I'm going to nod my head, write this down, and look at it later.
Exactly.
That's a put the pen to the mouth moment.
Yeah.
Pensive face.
Yes, pensive face.
Pensive face.
Exactly.
But this scene gave us a wonderful Silence of Lambs callback. With what is the first principal reason he does what he does. And, I mean, they change it enough, so it's not just that's incidental. They don't play that game,
play,
but they play it enough that we get it, and we're there, and I love when the show does that. Mm-hmm. And I especially love when the show does that with Will rather than with Hannibal.
Right.
Because, you know, this show, this season especially, is about trying to convince us of the similarities between Will and Hannibal.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
How they are two sides of a coin.
Right.
And so for Will to be delivering Hannibal dialogue from from Silence of the Lambs is just a wonderful way to reinforce that sort of subliminally to an audience who may be not as familiar with Silence of the Lambs as us, but probably have seen it, probably have it somewhere in their memory palace playing.
Right, exactly. And then it also draws us back to a lot of the original storyline.
Yeah.
Because, you know, we have created a whole new universe here, and we've definitely been creative with things, but there are wonderful moments where they go back and do little callbacks to original things. And we're going to go and remind you of, okay, who was the Chesapeake Ripper in the books? Because really, we're not doing anything much farther different than that. We're just...
The Chesapeake Ripper in this universe has killed a lot more people than the Chesapeake Ripper in the Thomas Harris
universe. Right. Well, because he's continued.
Yeah.
Yes.
He, you know, that's sort of the difference, is that he's still going. Mm-hmm. You know, they kind of cut him off, from the opportunity to continue to do that way before, you know, because Will is taking up that time, and that space and time that where it was supposed to be Hannibal in there.
Very true. Yeah.
So he's able to continue the crimes that in the book universe he was cut off.
He was stuffed. Yeah.
So... Yeah. Would you guys say that this has to be a separate universe? Can these two Hannibals no longer coincide?
I think because we've scrambled it so much. I mean, it's still going along the same trajectory.
Yeah.
Will is still working to put Hannibal in jail.
Right.
So, I mean, it's one of those things that, like, at the end of this season, I felt like I desperately want another season.
Mm-hmm.
But I felt like we have a prequel to Red Dragon now.
Right.
I felt sort of complete there.
Because we can still...
I could then watch Red Dragon and feel like I was in line.
And I think I may have mentioned this before, that by mixing and matching things with Will and changing up the storyline, it gives you the opportunity to tell this story for a much longer period of time, the way you need to in a TV show.
Yes, absolutely.
You know, see, you can condense it in a movie and in a novel and have it be this more shorter, more compactly told story. Not that the overall timeline of the story is compact.
Mm-hmm.
If you're putting it into one book or putting it into a two-hour movie, you only have so much story you can tell. In a TV show, you have to tell tiny increments of a story over a long period of time. And I think they're sort of able to take the concentrated elements of the novels and the movies and use those ingredients to then draw out a longer story.
We also have to consider that this entire storyline
sort
of exists in about three paragraphs in Red Dragon.
Pretty much, yeah.
You know, these little paragraphs about what happened pre-Red Dragon.
Yeah.
And that's fascinating
because
we're building this huge thing. I don't think at this point, as we are, episode 206, it needs to exist in a separate universe.
Mm-hmm.
I think by the end of the season, it's sort of a rebooted story. And from what I know of next season, it's definitely gone into rebooted universe, which I'm completely fine with.
Yes.
I love the way they're remixing the stories. And I think they've demonstrated time and again that they know when to pull what cards.
Right, exactly. I think I would be really disappointed if they... dropped the fancy mixing of the concoction.
Yeah.
And then did a straight adaptation. I would be really disappointed. I love when I catch, little bits and pieces of a part in a book.
Yeah.
A quote in a movie. When they called back to how are they going to get, in touch with, the other serial killer and they actually do it using the Tatler and, oh, well, we could put an ad in there. And it even calls back to Hannibal, how they wind up getting Clarice in trouble for something she didn't do because they put down that they it's were
true. Very true.
Communicating with each other through ads, and she had never placed them, right. And that's how they get her. You know,
because that was Mason Berger, right?
Placing and the ads? And what's his name? Krenler.
Oh yeah, Krenler. Yeah. Yes, Berger we got to see what they're going to wind up doing with Katie Purnell.
Yeah, because she hasn't been around in a while.
Friendler.
I don't think we see her again till towards the end of the season. She doesn't have much to do this season.
Mm-hmm. But I'm liking this. Yeah. I'm liking what they're doing with it and the mixing it up and having Will sort of play this character right now that's
dark.
Yeah,
that's angry.
Mm-hmm.
And. The very different version of Hannibal in Red Dragon versus Hannibal in Silence of the Lambs.
Mm-hmm.
Because Hannibal in Silence of the Lambs is removed from things and he's playing with Clarice.
Yeah.
Hannibal in Red Dragon is furious
that
this guy who is not his equal managed to put him in jail.
Yes.
And he plays it furious.
Yes.
And I look forward to seeing Hannibal Lecter.
I think from what we've seen at the beginning of this episode.
Oh, yeah.
We've already gotten a very strong hint that we're going in that direction. And as we see him progress in this season, the smugness, he's no longer as disguised.
Well, because he's not in control.
Mm-hmm.
He's working on control, and he keeps rebuilding these things. And we see at the end when his masterstroke is revealed and he completes his composition, that is a ha. I've taken it back. You thought you had it,
right.
But I've taken it back.
And I'm composing.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's sort of his version of this is my design.
Exactly. Well, now, Will played his card. Mm-hmm. That was Will's card at the end of the last episode. That was his only move.
Mm-hmm.
And now that that didn't work, now he's a lot more forthcoming with Jack.
Oh, yeah.
It's like, oh, yeah, okay, so the reason the Ripper kills in Sounders of Three, I still love the Sounders.
Sounders of Three and Four.
Three and Four is because he doesn't want the meat to spoil.
To spoil, yes.
And
if he waits too long, then the meat spoils.
Yes, if the Ripper is killing and Hannibal is having a dinner party.
Yes.
And then Jack tries to go, oh, so he's like Jacob Hobbs, and he's like, no.
No, he's nothing like Jacob.
Jacob Hobbs ate to honor his
honor
victim.
Him.
Yeah.
It's like the Ripper thinks of us as no more than pigs. Yes. Yeah.
Those he kills, though. He does say those he kills. He doesn't say all humanity is pigs.
No. No, yeah. it's definitely just the ones he kills.
Those he kills as no better than pigs.
Yeah. And that's when they do that amazing segue.
Oh, God,
Who does he have to kill before?
Into Alana and King Hart.
They're skewering the heart.
Yes.
Hannibal was in casual mode.
Yeah.
He was wearing a blue shirt.
No, he wasn't wearing a button
The top
down.
Button was unbuttoned.
Yeah.
No, he was wearing a button down, but it was unbuttoned at the neck.
But it wasn't like a dress shirt.
The man just almost died.
Yeah.
This is my point of contention in the episode. Mm-hmm. Almost died, and from dialogue, extremely recently, like within the last week, no bandages?
Well, they do True. Show...
Oh, yeah, I know.
Yeah.
But no bandages?
Well, yeah,
no, it'd be covered with bandages, especially if he was cooking.
Yeah.
They would... And him being a doctor, no.
And the fact
surgery.
That he still had sutures in there,
yeah.
that wouldn't have been open like that.
So just more for just a thing,
yeah.
More for
like infection and stuff like that. You want to keep it covered.
It was for dramatic effect that it wasn't bandaged.
Yeah.
Now, do we feel that Hannibal is just playing Alana from this moment any at all, or is he actually having a legitimate conversation? Because he talks about. How he's having nightmares now, and he never had nightmares before. Do we feel that Hannibal is actually having nightmares, or is he just playing the victim card?
Victim.
I think. I know, it's real...
There are
moments in this conversation I'm not sure, only because I wonder if this is another one of those I'm looking for a friend moments.
Yeah.
For Hannibal.
Mm-hmm.
That...
Will can't be his friend, so now let's go to Alana again.
And
Jack's starting to be
suspicious,
grumpy, and suspicious.
Yeah, their sort of like little friendship even though he says, "Oh, you're a good friend."
Yeah.
And
I don't think Hannibal felt the Jack thing until
that was later.
You're right.
But I think this may have been the face. That he's been sort of trying to cultivate friendships the way he did with Will and the way he did with Jack. You know, and then he still invites Chilton over to have these very, like, you know, sort of cryptic conversations.
Well, I think it's like fencing.
Yeah. Like fencing.
I mean, he's inviting Chilton over to parry with him.
Well, what's the good of being the best if you can't...
If you can't rub it into the crony's
that
face.
You're
yeah.
the best.
Exactly.
There are two lovely lines at the end of this sequence. First, he's metabolizing the experience by composing this new piece of music, which is wonderful.
And I love...
Because it's, again, a food thing.
Yeah. And Alana says, harpsichord or theremin.
Harpsichord or theremin.
She knows.
She knows.
And then I need to get my appetite back.
Yes.
To which we go to the Rolodex.
Yes.
And it's another Rolodex episode. And as that one last season, I love it.
Rolodex heart.
But first.
There's a short Rolodex.
Surreal flowers
which is
blooming.
The flowers blooming, yeah.
Yes.
And then we go to the tree man. And then opening credits. I mean, like, tree man.
Yeah.
Boom.
Bam.
Opening credits.
And done, shot in a way that is also very surreal.
Oh, yeah. With the smoke.
It's kind of foggy. And you don't really see the background.
And it's in a massive parking lot.
Yeah, you can tell it's a parking lot, but you can't see buildings around it because they kind of fog out.
No, it's the parking lot.
Right.
It's a Costco.
It's a Baltimore Costco. It's a Baltimore.
Thanks.
You don't like that?
Did that
take it down for you a little bit?
No.
when we go back to this, we have a sort of reverse pendulum thing.
Yeah.
Because there's nothing there. It's just the tree man.
And then
a cut, and then there's a cop there. And then a cut, and then there's more cops there. And then there's all our people. Zeller and Price. Zeller specifically is really delightful in this episode.
Oh, yeah, he has a lot of funny lines.
He mentions varicose vines. And then when he doesn't get a laugh, he just sort of goes,
Fines.
And Price isn't even in.
Price doesn't laugh.
And later in the episode, when they're all proud of the location of where the body was, out of focus in the background, you see Zeller just sort of nod and his eyebrows go up and nothing.
And
he's just like, yeah?
Yeah?
Aren't we awesome?
Aren't we great?
Jack knows an awful lot about poisonous flowers.
I thought that was very interesting. Yeah, because he's like, belladonna for the heart, only, ragwort. And then Price is like, all poisonous, like how they figure that all out just by looking at, unless it was because Bella had a garden.
I'm fine with that. It's just Jack is demonstrating a skill he has never demonstrated before.
True.
Which is basically being Will and Hannibal, which means the FBI doesn't really need these extra people. Mm-hmm. They could just do it themselves.
Yeah.
So I can speak to the analysis of poisonous flowers. In one of the classes that I took in an undergraduate level, so we know Jack is way above that. But in an undergrad, we had forensic botany, where we actually did study belladonna. We did study all the plants that could be used to kill someone, because it could simulate a heart attack, et cetera, et cetera, cause your bowels to bleed out.
But would you be able to pick it out visually?
I know what foxglove looks like, because it has digitoxin in it.
And, again, Jack may know it, and he may know it for a number of reasons.
It'll kill your pets, too.
He may know it because he's a guy who reads about stuff, right?
Right.
I mean, there's a lot that's of
come
reasons.
Up in investigations with the FBI.
Yeah.
Basically,
people use that a lot.
Towards
to kill
the
their
end
spouses.
Of. that's true. Mm-hmm. Towards the end of CSI, after Gil Grissom left, Lawrence Fishburne took over as head of investigation.
Does he really? Oh, dear.
And this sequence.
Seemed very much like
felt that. Like that. Mm-hmm. There are a few CSI moments in this where people who are not normally that type of clever, because Jack is clever.
Yeah.
He's not that type
he's
of clever.
He's not normally, no, he never has analyzed anything far as I know.
Yeah, this is the first time he gets
analytical. It feels like the show didn't know what to do with a crime scene because they didn't have their people who usually say things like, oh, he despised him, or, you know,
mm-hmm. it's some kind of character analysis.
He had contempt.
This guy was dirty.
Unless Jack's playing the game.
Yeah. Because he does. He tries to figure out what the poison means. Like, yeah. You know, so, it's something about it makes, you know, the sort of, is this person poison? Is this, sure. You know, something about this person makes him sick, and, you know, that he has to treat the body this way. And then I guess, you know, what's interesting too is that after that you have Jack and Hannibal having the conversation, and he tries to bring him in to, and he refuses.
Because Hannibal, it's funny because it's the same kind of thing that Will tried to do last season, and Jack was not having it.
Right.
But Hannibal says about Will that he's in a dark place where the shadows move, and it's not safe to stand with him anymore. Mm-hmm. And that's also a veiled threat.
Mm-hmm.
Because Will talks about that later in the episode with Gideon, is that it's anyone who's near him is marked.
Yes,
you are marked.
And so Hannibal saying this, he means it one way, Jack takes it that way, but it also is very specifically, it is not safe to stand with Will.
Right.
It's not safe because of outside forces. It's not safe because of
Hannibal
me.
Hannibal will get you.
Yeah.
And Hannibal can't dwell on death anymore. So, he's hosting a dinner party.
Yes, we both have to and transfer to life-affirming
And Jack said,
events.
Yeah.
What?
What? Yeah. Oh, that look was totally, yeah. What?
Whoa. I had this conversation half an hour ago with Will in his cell about you having a dinner party.
And then, exactly.
So, when the notes turned into flowers...
Mm-hmm.
In Hannibal's composition, we go back into the lab with the tree man. I was wondering how they got the tree in the lab.
It was because they're cutting it apart in the lab.
Yeah, you'd think they would have had to do that out of the lab. Yeah. I mean, maybe it's got big bay doors. That's fine. I can go with that.
Right,
I just thought it was a unique thing to be in the lab and then see them cutting it apart.
They would want to keep as much of that in one piece into the lab as possible, because anything that could possibly shake free lint, hair, they'd rather be in that sort of hermetically sterile environment rather than have it fall on pavement and they get blown away by the wind, because you have a lot of the elements that would be working against you. What if it started raining? What if it snowed? Mm. What if?
Absolutely.
What if? It was quite impressive to have that in that room, though.
I'm sure they had, the dock bay doors type thing. I'm sure they've had to pull in
CSI, they pulled cars in.
They pull the whole car in with the bodies inside, especially if it's burned, because you don't want to lose any of that organic matter to the elements. So, yeah, if they can bring in a big car, they could probably bring in the tree. It is impressive, but...
It is.
Yeah.
So here's where we learn about our victim.
Yeah. His
politician. Name is Sheldon Isley. He's a politician who was fighting against the natural habitats of songbirds. So we got a little thing, a little silence thing, songbirds.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Again, it's unimportant, doesn't really matter, but we get the, he paved paradise to put up a parking lot. And I just wrote, who are you? That's it. That's CSI right there. You see the difference between this show and CSI, because that's the whole thing right there.
But, I mean, it's so kitschy, and honestly, it's not a major violation, certainly not one that would get you killed. There's got to be more to this that they don't actually tell us.
He's one of Hannibal's victims.
Yeah.
More to this may have meant he was just a dick.
Yeah.
Okay.
I think that's pretty much what it is that...
Because we're not doing Killer of the Week stuff anymore.
Right.
There's no reason.
Yeah.
Right.
This is somebody he thought was rude.
Yeah.
He
needed organs.
Yeah.
He was an organ
And he took
donor.
All of them except the lungs.
Yeah.
Except the lungs.
And here's where we learn about the diatoms, which is pretty cool.
Yeah.
Tree man bears fruit.
Bears fruit. Yes. Exactly. Yes. And they go and they show us the diatoms.
Yeah, so we know.
Yeah,
and that's a real thing.
What it is.
I was impressed. That was a cool thing.
Yeah.
Don't do anything about it yet. We learn that later.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a nice little...
Also true about locations. When you have a body that is upriver, if they breathed water before they died, you can actually get the water out of their lungs and find out where they were first put in. So if they were dropped off at the top of a lake and then ended up all the way down at the bottom, you know...
You would know about the fluid that was in their lungs.
Yeah, or if they were, you know, carried along a river, I should say. You'll know about where they were because the diatoms are very specific. So you'll get specific genus and species in that area.
Mm. And they show us a little bit of a map.
They do. We get something.
We are getting closer.
So when Jack and Alana are out in the woods with the dogs, lovely scene. Alana was wearing a lot of blue, really blue.
And it was really orange and yellow in the background.
Yeah. So just beautifully lit scene. Mm-hmm. Jack was wearing some blue too.
Yes, they were both in blue.
But then both at the end of the scene, remember how we said that Winston looks at the camera?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It's from that same angle that the bars of the cage appear over the scene.
Mm-hmm.
So it's sort of implying that Winston is looking at Will, who's seeing what his friends are off doing.
Mm-hmm.
He's imagining how they're talking about him, almost. And while he's doing that, he's growing a tree
of antlers.
So he grew the modified rack last episode. It is actually a rack of antlers. I know you giggle every time I say it, but that is actually what it's called.
It's a rack of antlers. But we have to giggle because
nice rack. But this was extensive.
And it looked thorny.
Yeah.
It was that combination.
It was like a combination.
Oh, and I love the way they just press their way through the grate at the top of the cage.
And they come and they split off, and he's gripping onto the iron bar.
And then it's hello, Dr. Light.
Yes.
Yeah, it's like, this. You have brought this out of me.
Yes. Actually, I was going to ask about that. And I think, no, that's good, because it also implies it's Will grappling with that side of himself, realizing he has to embrace it more and more in order to get through this, and then the master of that wanders in and plays this whole little hurt game. I feel like I was looking at our friendship on a split screen. And he just can't understand why his version of the friendship doesn't match reality, and Will just spits things he said back at him.
I don't have the gauge for reality to know if I'm lying.
And I love the way he says that. To know if I'm lying.
Yeah. I thought was really interesting, and I don't know what he really meant by it, is I am singularly angry at
whoever tried to murder. Well, it's because Hannibal was blaming. It's like, you should take responsibility. You're just angry at yourself. And he's like, no, I'm not angry at myself. I'm angry at you.
Not even on the slightest bit.
Yeah. He's not even a little bit.
That emphasizes where Will's at, which I love, because it really reinforces.
He's not doubting
that
himself at all.
Yeah. Indeed.
Well, I think, isn't this around the time where, we said Hannibal says, I think you're
more in control now than you ever have been. You found a way to hurt me.
Yes.
I wonder how many more people are going to get hurt by what you do. Sure would be a shame if something happened to Alana Bloom.
Yeah.
I mean, I hope she's got insurance because she might wind up in the hospital.
Exactly. You never know what's going to happen. Oh, yeah.
You know, she goes outside all the time with those dogs.
Yeah, I'll give her your love.
Yeah, I'll give Alana your best. Yeah,
your best.
And this is Hannibal at his most angry. He is definitely hurt because of the friendship thing.
He's
angry because Will is so much in control. And he can't manipulate him
right now. He can't.
And every time he tries, you know, Chilton segues around. Yeah.
Yeah.
No. I know you. Chilton's playing a dangerous game.
Yeah, and I think, you know, it's so interesting that Hannibal seems, like, honestly hurt.
He does.
You know, that there's...
But he seems honestly hurt in the way that a person that doesn't actually feel hurt
is.
So it's like, it's the closest approximation of the feeling of hurt that this monster can muster. Yeah.
And it also comes from this weird, skewed way of looking at his world, in that he's, you know, he's hurt because this person was able to get inside and get close enough to him
to make him feel the desire for friends.
Right. And then is also smart enough to get in and close enough to get him hurt.
True.
You know, that it's sort of a combination of not being so divorced from how human beings interact that he's shocked that Will would want to kill him despite all the terrible things that he's done with him, done to him. But then also it seems combined with, I can't believe you've managed to get this close to me.
Yeah.
Because I'm too good for that.
I feel like with Hannibal's range of emotions that we've seen, it's plausible that while he was up on the bucket, crucified there, that he went through some sort of realization.
He may have, yeah.
And it's, honestly, it takes a lot of care and consideration to try to have Hannibal Lecter killed.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that is not something you take lightly. I mean, you recognize the monster that's standing in front of you.
Mm-hmm.
Then you have to sort of calibrate the monster that's in front of you, then try to combat the monster that's in front of you, then try to, you know, execute a plan, and to be honest, yes, Will made do with what he was given, but he was sort of served that on a platter. But as soon as he saw that opportunity, he didn't hesitate for a second.
No, he took it, yeah.
He took it, and he went for it, and so maybe Hannibal's like, wow, you really do care, Will. But why'd you have to care like that?
Right.
Like, why'd you have to show me how much you care?
I think it's more,
to have me killed?
It's more like,
I am disappointed.
So he was, you know, he was playing a game. All this time, he's just been playing a game.
Mm-hmm.
And Will had to go and take it too far. and now, I mean, it's seriously, yeah. You know, he keeps touching the hot stove because it's fun. Mm-hmm. Just touch it a little bit. Touch it a little bit. It's fun. Yeah. It's sexy. And then suddenly,
he's burned.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's not fun anymore.
It's not fun.
And I think you're right. He does respect it a little bit. But at this, and he even says that, you know, if I were the person who killed Beverly Katz, I couldn't help but feel a little respect for your attempt.
Mm-hmm. Yes, he does. He gives total credit to Will's attempt. He does.
But he's not.
He's like, you know, nice try, buddy.
He's not playful anymore.
No.
I mean, that's the time for playing is over.
But that could also be that mirror that's being held up to Hannibal in a way.
Sure.
He's not just testing to see if there's a bit of himself in Will, he's seeing.
Well, maybe then there's a little respect in it too. In general, because the way he plays this scene, it's not just outright anger. It's not outright betrayal. It's a little hurt, but it's also it's like okay.
Okay.
Now, if he's looking into the mirror and seeing himself,
we are upping the game.
Yeah.
It's like okay, I can't. Yeah, the kid gloves are off now.
Mm-hmm.
A game is afoot.
While Hannibal is cooking his little
pulling
hors d'oeuvre,
out the roll. This is the great montage.
We've got hearts, three hearts, which is nice.
Yeah,
I love the little brazier he's got. You know, just that little grate with the coals in it.
Yeah,
and he's cooking just the little hors d'oeuvres and the prosciutto roses.
Yeah.
Oh
watermelon.
My God!
So
on watermelon,
hungry.
Watermelon,
hungry,
and then the beef tartare.
Yeah,
hungry making. And what's interesting to me is I've been thinking about this. So, could his victims have been in some of the orders, just not the ones?
Well, I think that's definitely what it was, because Hannibal did seem very concerned.
He did. He had a moment where he was like,
and if there was,
and then it was a kind of like, well, all right, this is how you find out. This is how you find out.
Well, you look at it. Okay, how much is actually in Hannibal's kitchen there? There are hors d'oeuvres, but it's not at the beginning when he's cooking the hors d'oeuvres with these with the heart. There's not a lot.
No,
he makes them, and all these people have been there at the party and eating.
Right.
So it's definitely possible that he had his chefs also make some hors d'oeuvres.
And it's not like he would use the entire human bodies of his victims just so that they could be consumed, because he's not trying to honor them.
Right, exactly.
He would only take the best of their meat, which probably would not feed that entire dinner party.
Absolutely.
Right. So there's got to be some real beef in there somewhere.
So he has to take the chance that whatever is on that platter that is Jack's not taking. What he, right. you know,
it's not what he especially prepared.
Well, and if he says, I'll have my man get something for you from the kitchen,
he can
that
choose.
Means there is other food in there right. that is not.
That is
human.
Not, yeah.
So it is definitely very likely. And if these just came out of the kitchen.
Right,
so, exactly. And there's a lot of ambiguity, but I'm willing to go along with the idea that it was blind, dumb luck.
That there was no people
in the food.
Disappointingly so.
When the dinner party is being set up, when that choreographed setup,
the waiters
with the Philip Glass style scales and the music,
they basically were doing a dance around the table.
Yes. The table. Yeah.
And then we transition to the string quartet as mm-hmm. people and fill in the restaurant. Alana is the only one in blue.
And yes, she's in like cobalt blue.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That was something. Yeah. I mean, stood mm-hmm. out a lot
yeah.
there.
Yeah, because everyone else, they're continuing with that sort of dark, it's a very dark blue palette. There's nothing very strong.
Yeah.
Because it's a group, they couldn't do everybody in blue, but they specifically kept to the earth tones that they've been using, gold, kind of a dark cream, some browns. And then there's the sort of, there's the really dark brick red accents.
Yes.
Which is very, very
on, much on the almost everybody.
Palette. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And when we were at the opera, we had those red accents. Yes. So that's sort of like, the black and red
we've seen this a lot.
That's the aristocracy here. That's the, mm-hmm. The upper crust, right. the creme de la creme, who would be at Hannibal's, soiree.
Right.
And I was Hannibal disappointed Ellen Green wasn't there.
Oh, sorry.
Because I always love seeing Ellen Green.
They were not very specific with people.
Yeah,
with
no, not at all.
Yeah. Except for Jack Chilton.
Well, and I know why. It's because it's not about them.
Right.
At this point, we're seeing the party not from Hannibal's point of view, which is what we saw the last party from. We're seeing it from Jack watching people eat, including Alana.
Which is wonderful. Yeah. He watches them slowly.
You almost wait for him to pull a Charlton Heston and slam his hands down on the things and just,
Everybody, it's people! Stop eating!
It's people.
And Chilton showing up and picking up the little bird claw.
Squab claw. Yeah. It's like,
okay, so we looked this up today.
Yeah.
Because
it was driving me crazy. Janice Poon, who is the...
the designer
the food
for the food.
Stylist.
Yeah, food stylist.
The food stylist for the show actually has a website. Go check it out if you want to know how this all comes together. She did a wonderful blog, and basically she shows her sketches, and she talks about the process, about what they tell her when she gets notes about things, how they talk about when she talked to the chef that she works with, who actually comes up with the workable menu or the workable, dish. They showed, all of the sketches, because
it's squab.
Yeah, it's squab.
And it's on a fig paste on top of a fig Newton. And the idea was the fig Newton represents cookie hell, and the squab claw is escaping up from cookie hell.
This is
the level of detail that the show gets. Mm-hmm. And it gives us this wonderful moment in the show where Chilton is just staring at it.
Oh,
like,
it's so
like
great.
Mortified about what this is.
Like, just
needless to say, I won't be eating anything tonight.
Yes.
He's happy.
He's happy for his lack of
his inability to eat animal proteins
anymore.
And the reason he's there is survival of the fittest.
Yes, Darwinism.
He doesn't want Hannibal to think he didn't want to show up to his party.
Right, right.
Because that would be suspect.
I don't want him to suspect me. Right. I shouldn't even be talking to you.
Right. I love the little...
And then, Hannibal the Cannibal.
Yes.
That's what they'll call him.
That was another great little shout out.
And there. That's the first time we hear that.
Yes, it is the first time we hear that.
So when Jack goes over, I think I understand that he is asking Hannibal's permission to take evidence out of the house.
And I think for him, investigation-wise, it is vitally important that it is not taken surreptitiously.
Right, exactly.
Or it has to be, or forcefully. It is,
Do I have your permission? Yeah. And Hannibal is visibly shaken by this.
Yeah.
And I love that he tips back to Will's dialogue at the beginning by saying, eat it soon or it will spoil.
It will spoil.
Which for Jack should be a direct callback to Will saying,
that conversation.
You know, that if he doesn't want it to spoil. But then when Hannibal looks over at Chilton and then just gives him the little wink.
And Chilton's like,
oh dear God. Does that mean you're going to eat me?
I don't know. Chilton spends a good majority of this episode looking like a deer in the headlights. Totally just like terrified and skittish. I know we haven't covered that, but Chilton's reactions to everything in this scene are because of what he has listened to.
Yes.
And he knew, but it's really starting to fall into place for him. And even though he's always known that he's had to keep Hannibal at a safe distance, but not so distant that he couldn't watch every move and be in control.
Right.
That whole thing of, no, this is Darwinism, this is survival, you know, I need him to know that I am not a threat. So that by continuing to go to dinner with him and continuing to go to these events, he's afraid that if I start distancing myself from him, it's going to put out a flare.
Absolutely.
But in the meantime, while he almost needs to do it more desperately as the episode continues, because his eyes are now even more, everything he suspected, you know, it's sort of like now he can't, it's not hidden anymore.
Right.
He can't unsee it.
He can't unsee it.
Exactly. And now he sees it everywhere. A quick point about Hannibal's decor. In the front room, he has antlers on the wall.
Yes.
Antlers on a table.
Yes.
And what looks like a Christmas tree
made that of is antlers. Half antlers. Yes.
I mean, I guess he just embraced the idea. It's like, Will's seeing antlers, so let's put some antlers around.
Yeah, even when he's composing harpsichord, that's all the skulls and everything on the table.
I believe that was a ram skull in that scene.
So Jack takes the food to the lab,
and hands it to him, and they're like, what?
When we come back, there's an argument about Wagyu versus Kobe beef, because it is all cow.
Yes.
There are no people.
Yeah, they're like cow, pig... Yeah, foul. There's no people. So, and then they have a little banter of, you know, it's Wagyu.
Always,
and then it's like, well, isn't
it's
that
always Kobe, but it's never Kobe, but not always.
Wagyu.
Yeah,
yeah. All Wagyu is Kobe, but not all Kobe is Wagyu.
Right.
Yeah,
is what he tells them. You know, it is always funny when they argue those little
because they're playing the one-upsmanship about we are clever.
Very geeky, nerdy.
It is.
You know, one-upmanship. You know, that they each have their thing that they know. That Price comes up with this, you know, he seems to have these little hidden gems of knowledge.
Like the bees.
Like the bees, exactly.
Because I like bees.
Yeah, because I like bees. Apparently he's a fan of Wagyu beef. And he's like, oh, that's like $200 in that plate right there. Exactly.
So we have Gideon back in this episode.
Yes.
Which is wonderful.
He's speaking wonderful. Of bees.
When we have that amazing split screen where Gideon and Will are both sitting up against the back of their cell.
Yeah.
And it's sort of lining up. And as it's lining up, we see a rat scamper up between the cells.
Yes.
Which is almost like a Simpsons gag. Like when they would go from the main floor to the upper floor, there was always something in the space between floors.
Exactly.
But just a touch that you wouldn't expect. And a lovely one at that. And this scene between Will and Gideon, you know, Will is just, you're stamped with an expiration date. The moment I convinced Chilton to put you next to me.
Yes.
You know, and the only way you and Chilton will get out of this alive is to catch the Ripper.
To catch,
I mean, Will is
You know, you will not live.
Yeah. And then we get the wonderful moment where Gideon says to tell Jack Crawford that I sat in his cobalt blue dining room and just goes on about exactly.
Yeah, in the corner with what a the swan great... above the table.
Yes.
And then Chilton sitting at his laptop like, oh my God.
Oh my God, I've been in that room.
And not knowing whether he's excited or horrified.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. At the same, because there is a certain...
Because that's the realization moment. Yeah. That's the moment where he realizes that Hannibal Lecter, this person he aspires to be, maybe being a little bit off, but very, very, very likely is the Chesapeake Ripper. That's almost a Kaiser Sose moment.
Right.
That's the, now I'm seeing all the things.
Everything in the room and all the words and all
the coffee.
Drop the coffee and the Kobayashi mug.
Yes.
The Kobayashi mug. It's a really tremendous thing to have a character not need that, but we know that that's what's happening to him because he has interacted with Hannibal very extensively throughout his career.
Mm-hmm.
And to now be able to see everything through fresh eyes.
And then also this is, you know, having thought that he caught this
person before. I think it's horror, honestly. I think he is scared because when he interacts at the dinner party with Jack, he says...
Oh, he's terrified.
He fits the profile, Jack.
Yeah.
Fits the profile.
He fits the profile.
But he's also sort of like, his desire for fame, for helping catch the Ripper, has put him into game mode, where he's just like, isn't it amazing?
Yeah.
Like, look at us, we're stupid. He was right in front of us. Right, look at him, he's right there. Yeah,
come on.
Let's go get him.
His fascination with the medical career, that he was almost a surgeon. And
need to stop him before he kills me.
Before he kills me.
Yes. Yeah,
exactly.
He's right there, Jack. He's right there.
Come on, help me, Jack.
And I have a hard time having Jack be so skeptical at that point when he's listening to the recording. Will Graham could have given him the details.
He could have, yeah.
But why
he's
would
so
he?
Susceptible to...
Why would he care?
Yeah.
At this point, Will's trying to kill Hannibal any way he can.
Yeah.
I mean, you think he's going to waste his time
then
telling
Chilton
lies?
Then Chilton does the, he once served me tongue and made a joke about eating mine. Which I think was the first episode we ever saw Chilton.
Yeah.
He was over at Hannibal's house eating.
Particularly chatty lamb.
Particularly chatty lamb. That should be silenced.
That should be up.
Oh, too much fun.
Well, the sound design in this scene was really interesting because we brought back the water droplet sound, and it was used to punctuate a big reveal type moments in the dialogue, which was nice. This back and forth between them as they're convincing each other that this is a likely thing, you know? And they talk about how cannibalism is an act of dominance.
Dominance, yes. I thought that was really interesting, too.
And that is very Hannibal Lecter.
What I also thought was really interesting about the scene is that it made me think of when Hannibal in Silence of the Lambs talks the other inmate into
swallowing his tongue. Mix, yeah. Mm.
Yeah, exactly. It had that same feeling to it where he uses the language and the fear and he's pushing sort of Gideon psychologically into telling him what he wants by basically saying, you know he's going to kill you. He's going to kill everybody. And he's definitely going to kill you and Chilton. He gives him...
Because you pretended to be the Ripper.
Yeah, exactly. You know, if there's anybody here who needs to be afraid, it's you. And
anyone who's going to wind up as the wound man.
Wound man, exactly. I mean, he really just like... pushes his psychological buttons
as much as possible.
Yeah, into goading him into doing something, and it made me think of sort of the way Hannibal had the ability to, through his words, to manipulate another cellmate, basically, into harming themselves. Mm-hmm. And he seems to be playing a very similar psychological game, where Gideon has been playing it rather cool the whole time he's been there, and then this pushes him.
Right.
Over the edge into spilling everything. basically to save his own skin. You know,
but then recants it and decides to play a different game.
Yes.
Because what fun is life if you can't play games?
Right, right. Well, I think when you have Hannibal right in front of you...
Yes.
That was his way of backpedaling and... Because if he said it right then
I don't
there,
believe I've ever seen you before.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. As people who... Was it... As people who were trained to...
No. Our minds have recognized faces with so many... Mm-hmm. Are trained to recognize faces with so many points, but I don't believe I've ever seen yours before.
Yeah.
So when Chilton is having Gideon brought back to his cell here... Mm-hmm. It seems like this is the first time they are talking since he has been brought back to Baltimore State Hospital.
Because he did not want any other interaction.
And Gideon says to all the king's horses and all the king's men could indeed put Humpty together again. And then he says, is everything back where I found it?
Yes. And he's like, more or less.
Not everything.
Not everything.
But then... It's weird because Gideon's brought back to his cell, but then brought to a cage to talk to Jack.
Yes.
So, where was Gideon? Why wasn't he in his cell?
He was...
I don't know.
It's weird.
Yeah. I didn't even think about it.
Because it felt like... I mean, it really felt like a death march when like Gideon's being brought to his cell and Chilton's just standing there in the middle.
Yeah.
It's like... When the warden is standing outside the cell in Shawshank Redemption.
Ah.
So Gideon's in the cage and completely recants his... No, right. I've never seen Hannibal before. Mm-hmm. But I love the sociopath has not been used by any respected psychiatrist since 1968.
Exactly. And he pokes Chilton.
Oh, yeah.
Mercilessly.
You know, if Chilton wasn't there, he may have told Jack the truth. Yeah. But the very fact that Chilton was there and Chilton had just given him a whole lot of shit, I think that may be, you know, that may have been enough to convince Gideon to change his story. Right there.
Just because of all that. Yeah.
So Chilton shared the dining room looks, and Jack said, why would he do that? And Chilton's like, why would he do that?
Yeah.
But the interesting thing is when Gideon implies that Chilton is the Ripper. As they're leaving, he's like, you know, you've got the right box there, Jack, but you're looking in the wrong corner.
The wrong corner. I didn't think he was implying Chilton there, though.
I think it feels like a... You know,
I thought it was more of a... He doesn't want to outwardly say that he knows it's Hannibal. But he also realizes that Jack has been sniffing in the corner that Will is in.
Sure.
And basically it's sort of that same game that Will was playing in which he wouldn't come out and say who he thinks did it.
Right.
I want you to figure it out. And he wants, Jack to say the name or someone else to say the name. He doesn't want to come out and say it. And I think in what it felt like to me in that instance, it was even though he denied all of that, basically, oh, it was a lot of CYA. He's covering his own ass here. He wants to make sure that not only does he not get killed by Hannibal, but he does get nailed by the FBI.
Yeah, very
because,
true.
Because he has information that he's been withholding that could have helped Will or helped the investigation. But he's able to kind of, without coming right out and letting Chilton know that he's still trying to help, it's a hint of...
Very true.
Yes, I just told you that it's not Hannibal.
And then at the same time, he can embarrass Chilton.
Yeah.
And that's a benefit.
Yeah. And I think he was more hinting that, not specifically Chilton, but that he should stop looking at Will.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that was the gist of that. And I think it was pushing him in the direction of Hannibal without saying it.
Okay.
Yeah.
When Gideon's being brought back to his cell, and he's almost playing the poke the bear game, I asked her if she had eyes for me. She said no, so I had to take them.
I know she was loved by all, but
wasn't she a bit of a good time girl
with a beer in her?
It's like we're flashing back to Chilton's weird history with the panty girdle.
Yes.
It's like, who talks like this? What is this?
Oh, and he's just mercilessly just, you know. And to come after Chilton with this whole thing of, you know, people, and I understand that nobody really likes me, but the nurse was, you know, liked by everyone.
Yeah, absolutely.
And sort of really fearlessly attacking, like threatening Gideon.
Well, do you think that Gideon, it almost feels like he severely misjudged a plan.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if he is attacked in this institution, he will be moved back out of this institution.
Uh-huh.
So it's almost like he's pushing them enough to punch him.
To make him get attacked.
And then he can immediately get his lawyer on the...
Right.
And but he does not see them beating the shit out of him and then throwing him off a staircase. That
montage is just cringeworthy.
It's very difficult to watch.
Yeah. It is. It's all in slow motion.
Oh, that initial spray of blood.
It makes your whole body. Yeah.
Now, what do they call that? Is it? It's not a billy club, but the one that you sweat. But it's collapsible. It's a tiny little metal rod, and
I think it's a riot baton, isn't it?
But you take it and you fling it out and it locks, like each extension locks inside itself, and at the end there's kind of like a knob.
When Gideon is held out over the staircase, and our albino guard and the blood dripping into his coffee.
And visual, and I like watching the creamer in my coffee just for the same thing. Yeah. You see the two different
the colors
and the viscosity, and you start to see the blood blend.
Yes.
Well, and it was shot in that extreme slow motion, like we've seen for those really extreme close-ups of the water droplets, where you see the coffee rise up out of it and form its own droplet and then fall back in. Yes. So they're using all sorts of camera techniques in this episode that you just don't see.
Unless you watch a lot of physics videos.
Well, yes.
And ferrofluid and that sort of thing.
But it also sets up this tension because we don't know what's going to happen next.
No.
And then they scare us by breaking the tension by the body
here. Yeah. Did either of you flashback to Hannibal on top of the elevator in Silence of the Lambs there?
Because
when I see a body laying on top of I immediately thought of that. It wasn't Hannibal on top of the, spoiler alert.
The guard.
It was the guard.
Yeah.
But that's where I went immediately.
Wow.
And
I'm surprised I didn't make that connection, but you're right, because it's very similar.
And then we don't know what is up with Gideon. We go to other
again
things.
Again with Gideon.
The dinner party.
Is he dead? He's dead. And then you see him.
He's gotta be
dead.
How did you survive?
We find him in the hospital bed. And we get this horror movie moment where
he's with the fluttering movement and the fluttering.
And Hannibal comes in lit from below, prepped for surgery.
Yes.
In like we just watched The Burbs.
Yeah.
And it's like the doctor saying, you were in my basement. You saw my skulls. And it's just like, the way he's lit, and it looks like he's smiling.
Yeah, and he pulls the mask down.
And the look on Gideon's face was just like,
of course. Fuck. Yeah. Yeah.
Great.
It's not fear.
No, it's not at all. It's just,
by the guards.
I expected
this. Well, isn't this nice?
And,
so I survived for this.
Yeah, exactly. I was surprised he's not in the kill suit.
Because he's not going to kill him then.
No, but he does kill the guard.
Oh my God, that's right. And he does that. He does quite
and
a bit.
And strings him
of,
up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe
yeah.
because he's in the surgical.
And that's before. Yeah. It is expected.
Yeah.
You know, that he would be pretty clean
yeah.
when in there.
That and then is pretty gruesome because you think it's going to be Gideon. And then you
and he strings up the guard face down with fish hooks
yes.
that are immediately recognizable as the kind of fish hooks Will used to tie.
And then compose the same elements.
This one has a tooth.
Yeah, a tooth and a hair. So right away, they know, well, I mean, even before they look at everything, they know without a doubt, these are elements of people.
Yeah.
And who else do we know who used to do that?
I love the little conversation that Jack has underneath the body.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. They're both looking
They're both under the open, cavity and the...
When the recognition comes. Mm-hmm. There was never a copycat. Yes. There was only the Chesapeake Ripper. Mm-hmm. And that's when Jack knows beyond a shadow of a doubt, Will did not do this.
Yeah. Well, that what's really is when they go and they have the analysis. You know, they have all the trays in the lab, and they start naming off everybody.
Miriam, Sheldon Isley, the judge, the muralist, then Abigail Hobbs, Sutcliffe, Marissa Scherr, and Georgia Matchin.
Yeah.
And, man, and that was hard to keep up with them when they were listing them.
Gigantic light bulb moment.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Where he... It was never Will.
And that the Ripper was finally taking credit for everything. It was the gloves are off.
Right.
This was me.
I'm not going to fake it being a copycat killer or being anyone else. You know, I'm proud enough of my work right now that I want everybody to know that it's me.
Indeed.
Yeah. And I'm smug enough to think, to not worry about getting caught. Yeah, that
I'm going to flaunt all this evidence in your face and you still won't find me.
Mm. So, the dinner sequence in this episode... You know, we've got a lot of great food
this
episode. But the elaborate thigh baked in clay
in a lotus leaf. Yeah.
My God. And I thought Eddie Izzard was superb in this episode because he's got, he's a big character.
Mm-hmm.
But he plays a lot internally in this episode, which is not normal for the character of Gideon, because he's playing it in he's pained because he knows what's happening, and he doesn't even know how to play it. He's usually playful. He doesn't even know where to go with this. When Hannibal says, "Shall I carve?" It's I think you already have.
And they show that he's missing a leg. Yep. And
this superb line. It's hard to have anything, isn't it, Dr. Lecter? Mm-hmm. Rare to get it, harder to keep it. A damn slippery life.
I loved that line because I felt that it was a bit prophetic.
Yeah.
That basically he's like, okay, you may have gotten me now, but what you're trying to do...
Yeah, you won't be able to keep this either. You won't
be able to keep
this. It's we all shall fall.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Today it's me.
Right.
Tomorrow they'll come for you.
They'll come for you.
And the you intend me to be my own last meal?
Meal.
Yes.
Yes. How does one go about
politely refusing?
Politely refusing.
One doesn't.
Exactly.
The tragedy is not to die, Abel, but to be wasted. And I love the beauty of the carving and the way Gideon just rolls with it at that point.
Mm.
And he eats it. My compliments to the chef. What a great send-off for a really wonderful character. And it's a damn shame. I mean, we haven't seen a body yet.
Yes.
And this show, as it will prove again tonight.
We already thought that he was dead once.
If you don't see a body.
Right.
Anybody could be resurrected.
And as we also said with Beverly, it's like he could come back in a flashback.
Absolutely.
Or they may go back in time. And
maybe he lives in Hannibal's memory palace.
Right. Exactly. Exactly.
So we circle around.
Do we see a victim that knows what's coming?
Very
true. Very rarely do we see a victim that knows what Hannibal's going to do with their body.
And is you know, okay, if I'm done, I'm done.
Mm.
So I may as well have a good last meal.
He sort of resigns himself to his fate.
Indeed.
And he's just going to deal it with aplomb and, yeah, at that point too, I think, you know, after all that he's been through.
Well, and Hannibal did say that he'd broken his,
his vertebrae.
So he was never going to walk again. No. That's period.
Yeah.
Really.
Your leg's just going to atrophy.
Yeah.
And be wasted.
And be wasted. And so this was a better use of them.
Yes. Yeah.
So
better eat it while it's still fresh.
So we're back to our other plot line here, to our big reveal of the episode.
Mm-hmm.
First, we find Madrona bark along with all these other things in the lures. And the Madrona bark is from a small stand of a rare tree in the Diatom search area.
Yes.
That brings us to a barn. He goes alone.
Yes. As he's wont to do. In every episode, he is alone.
Bad idea.
Yeah, it's weird.
They don't. It could be they don't want to pay the actors.
I mean, he had Alana as backup last time.
That's true.
So he had Alana as backup last time. So
because Alana is
very helpful. She's going to
know
helpful.
So much. Yeah,
she's the best backup.
She'll talk you down.
And as Hannibal plays his final notes of his piece triumphantly, we find Miriam Lass.
And that whole search scene keeps you so on edge.
Yeah.
And what I found very interesting about the implements that were in that room, even though they were farm implements and cooking, so they looked like medieval torture devices.
Yeah.
And, you know, that rack thing that was hanging from the ceiling and a lot of the cutting instruments, and which is very reminiscent to what Beverly was finding in his basement,
mm-hmm.
you know, and then they do the whole thing. It's like, oh, there's a lock on the door. Oh my God, what's going to be behind there? It's up on the door. Oh,
nothing.
Nothing. Oh my God. Turn the light on. There's a cistern on the floor. He's going to open it up. And it's like, you're almost looking through your fingers. Mm-hmm. Like,
nothing.
But then the third time's a charm.
Well, and another Silence of the Lambs callback. It's the girl in the well.
The girl in the well.
Puts lotion on its skin.
Yeah. On its skin. Exactly.
Jack could grab his nipples and go, you know, if you wanted
That's
to.
That's disturbing.
Yeah. It was plenty disturbing in the movie, but just think of how disturbing it would be if Lawrence Fishburne.
That's why I'm saying it's more disturbing.
We just played it through in our heads.
And then also,
I cannot see that.
Take it a bit further to the Goodbye Horses scene.
Oh, thank you.
Oh my God.
Would you fuck me? I'd fuck me.
Oh, Morpheus.
Oh, Morpheus.
Oh, that's definitely when you want to take the right pill.
So did you expect Miriam to come back?
I did not. No. I did not. No. Even though, like we've said, we've definitely learned in this show that there are no absolutes to when people are alive and dead. But I didn't see any sign of this coming. You know, I think mentally when the arm was there, my brain wrote her off.
Yeah.
Even though it's, you know, yes, somebody can be alive and it's quite obvious that she's still alive without her arm. But I think at that moment, I took that to be there's bits and pieces, you know, but I think I'm surprised that I did, because even though they keep talking about, you know, finding bits and pieces of Abigail, I would probably have been less surprised if it was her because Miriam Lass being kept alive like that is how I've been envisioning Abigail.
Okay.
That because they have not found a body, but they never like show us. They've never said, hey, here she is. But they've only ever intimated that there have been bits and pieces of her or DNA evidence. Exactly.
Oh, yeah. And the DNA in the lures.
And, yeah, the exactly. DNA. There has been moments where I'm just like, is he keeping her alive somewhere? There's going to be a reveal later on. I had a feeling a reveal like that was coming.
Sure.
I was not expecting.
When the other thing that you have to think about and that I thought about at the moment they revealed this is Miriam Lass disappeared a couple of years ago.
Yes.
And so the moment we see her arm, yes, it does give us the, oh, she's dead.
Yeah.
But we also have to recognize that the arm was rather fresh, and unless Hannibal just kept it in the freezer for 2 years just for this game
he's playing,
which seems unlikely.
Yeah.
It likely came off. Miriam alive. And so that, you know, and the first time we watched this, I did not expect Miriam either.
Yeah.
So it's one of those things where we should have, perhaps, expected Miriam to be alive, but the show played the misdirection card so well.
And that's what I'm saying, is that I fell for it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That my brain said, her arm, she's dead.
Right.
It drew that conclusion. And so that's sort of like now in retrospect, I'm like, no, I should not.
Right. The show has taught you how to judge.
I shouldn't because it could have been like, and as you said, it was quite obvious that if it's fresh, if it's, you know, there were a lot of signs, but my brain just automatically decided to write it off as, oh, okay, we've wrapped that little thing up. And I shouldn't have. Because the show has proven time and time again that just when you think that somebody...
don't
discount anybody. Don't discount
her. Well, I think it's also the value that Miriam Lass holds to Hannibal. At the time, did Hannibal see her value? Did he hold her until he realized what she meant and who she meant it to, and then realized that she has value as a pawn to be played at a later date? Is like a classic misdirection for Jack's attention. Mm-hmm. Did he see that?
It does.
It's a little bit of Hannibal as magic.
A lot of forethought.
It's a lot of forethought. Yeah. We're like 2 years into the future
now. And that's true. And
since but maybe he thought he'd have to pull the card sooner. Who knows?
Or maybe it was his protection.
It also could have been Hannibal was playing with this person.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I mean,
well, because she was very
let's look
smart
at it. Let's look
him.
At it as Clarice Starling.
Yes.
If Hannibal was able to put Clarice Starling in his basement or in a pit, wouldn't he have done that? Because how fascinating would he have?
You are fascinating. You found me. You saw me. You saw through my person suit, and I didn't have to show you.
How did you do that? Yeah.
How did you do that?
So, I mean, we don't know what happened to Miriam Lass, Ian.
Well, because he also
wants
to prevent that from ever happening again.
Yes.
He doesn't want to be caught unawares that somebody is marking him.
And
or
so
that
quickly.
Somebody is, you know, noticing him very quickly. Very quickly in Miriam's investigation of the Ripper. Does she find Hannibal and go straight to him? So, yeah, I think that he wants to study this like an insect under glass.
Mm.
How did you find? I want to know all the things that you thought to lead you to my office that day.
Mm.
If you want to email us, you can do so at eattherootcast@gmail.com. Follow us on Twitter at eattherootcast and check out our Tumblr, which, you know, once we finish this season, Miko will be all over the Tumblr because she can.
Oh, yeah, I'll be allowed.
You know, and
I'm going to peek at the Tumblr because I want to put my photos up this weekend.
Absolutely.
Hannibal's office, but I have to do so through, blinders. I can only put it up there long enough to not look at any spoilers.
And so that's eattherootcast.tumblr.com.
There's a lot of stuff I look forward to reading.
Oh, I know.
There's
commentaries on episodes.
Stuff on YouTube, all of the extras, our own Tumblr.
It's coming.
It's like I'm in a
therapy
stage right
now. We're getting there. So thanks for joining us at the table. I don't like that this is what they're doing with Alana Bloom, who is a very interesting character.
Yeah.
I am going to turn that off.
Because that's louder than I expected.
Yeah.
I have stuff to say.
I'd say it, just wait 1 minute.
You're listening to a Swingset podcast at swingset.fm.